This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. We continue our look at juvenile lifers in Michigan, those inmates sentenced to mandatory life without parole for crimes committed when they were minors. Let's get the perspective of someone who knows the correction system intimately. Patricia Caruso is the former director of the Michigan Department of Corrections. She served there from 2003 through 2010. She was also a warden at the Chippewa Valley Correctional Facility and Camp Pelston, and she's a past president of the North American Association of Wardens and Superintendents. Patricia Caruso recently spoke with Cynthia Canty.
Can you give us an idea of just what it's like for juveniles who are placed in adult prisons?
Well, I often say to people that one of the things that I am surprised if I do not see, and that is misconducts in prison, because think of a teenager coming into prison, regardless of what they did. They either are going to have a lot of misconducts trying to find their way in. When they tend to be fighting misconducts, they tend to be out of place, what we call formally disobeying a direct order. Any parent who's ever raised teenagers knows what all those things are because they deal with that stuff every day.
They do.
And it's no different in prison, except you're surrounded by people who are adults, who are all convicted felons and, you know, various levels of spectrum. You know, anyone who comes into prison is going to have to find a way to establish themselves. If you're coming in for life, I mean, this is all you're looking at. So that's part of what happens there. You know, some people pull inside themselves and pull back. Many get involved in other things.
What about as a manager? What kind of difficulties are posed by having juveniles in these adult prisons from that management level?
Well, I will tell you something, Cindy. I never thought about this originally when I was first involved in corrections. And at some point, when I was a warden, and it really solidified for me when I was the director of the entire system, it solidified for me that juveniles really don't belong in the adult system. The system really is not designed or equipped on any level to deal with them. And that's what part of the problem is. I remember touring, when I was the director of the department, touring a juvenile facility and looking at the resources that were available and just the physical plant layout designed for really seriously in trouble young people. And I'm thinking of those who are in my system and how hard it is. You know, if you're a warden in a prison, your job is to keep the people in that prison safe. I mean, everyone goes home safely every day, you know, with your staff. The lid stays on the joint as far as prisoners. That's what you want to do. And when you have young people, you are either looking at someone who perhaps is more vulnerable in that population or exactly the opposite, who is a big troublemaker, because that's how teenagers are.
What was the moment? You kind of touched on it at the beginning of that last answer. What moment opened your eyes personally to what it meant to be a 16 or a 17-year-old kid right there in adult gen pop?
I remember one day sitting at my desk in my office as a warden, and I'm reading, we call them kites, they're letters from prisoners. And so I had a letter from a prisoner he'd written to the warden, and he was telling me about different problems he was having. I had a multi-level prison, and he was in our minimum security unit, so that was our lowest level. In the end, the last paragraph said something like, "Please help me, warden. I'm only 16 years old." And I can still to this day see this. And I remember thinking to myself, my son is 16 years old. And it made a connection with me that I've never forgotten. And I remember going and getting the prisoner's file and looking in it to see why he was there. He really hadn't done anything all that serious in the big scheme of things. You know, he had obviously worn the system down from the community he was in, but he did not have any kind of extensive juvenile record at all. And I even made some calls to try and confirm that. So it got me to think a little bit differently about the path to prison for various populations coming in, not just juveniles, but the path is different for many. And it goes to the adequacy of, you know, defense representation. It goes to the community they come from. All kinds of things. Obviously, family issues. There's a lot there.
Patricia, since the Supreme Court decisions on these juvenile lifers, county prosecutors are supposed to be going through and reviewing each of the cases that are in their jurisdiction, individual reviews, looking at a lot of factors to determine if that person should be resentenced. And that includes what they've done with their time in prison. First off, are there limitations on what prisoners who have these life sentences can do? You know, what kind of activities or educational opportunities or job training that they can be part of?
Well, there are some limitations, yes, because, you know, Michigan, unlike many states, does classify prisoners, it's a combination of the length of their sentence and how they've done their time, how they're doing their time. And that's a good thing, how that happens. But it still means if you are serving life without parole, there are certain levels of custody that you will never get to. That means there are resources and programs and opportunities that you would not be exposed to.
And another thing prosecutors will be looking at is records of misconduct. But you've kind of indicated teenagers, their misconducts tell you more about them being teenagers than just really who they are or how they could be redeemed.
I think so. You know, I'm often asked to look at files of incarcerated persons and help someone who's not familiar with the system to know whether they should be concerned about what they're looking at. And I do talk about misconducts. There are misconducts that are very serious misconducts, and absolutely you should be looking at those. If you're looking at assault on staff, I mean, you're looking at escape attempts, there are a number of things that are serious misconducts, and you want to look at those. Over the years, and in fact, going back to probably my last year as the director of the department, we really changed how we classified a number of our misconducts, because many of them that you see, that of files I've looked at of current juvenile lifers, at the time they got these misconducts, they were classified as major misconducts. And those are the disobeying a direct order, out of place type things. But we don't consider those major misconducts anymore, because we recognize that they aren't a good predictor of long-term behavior.
Now, the Supreme Court, Patricia, said that life sentence without parole should be reserved for the rarest of cases. But we've seen many prosecutors in Michigan take the position that all or most of the juvenile lifer cases under their review meet that rarest standard. In your view, what type of person qualifies as rare, that someone who should receive that life sentence without parole?
You know, I have people ask me this fairly frequently, and it's a very difficult question to answer, certainly because of what I've done for a living. I'm aware of incarcerated persons who really, truly are sociopathic individuals. And all of us are better that these people are incarcerated for life. What I'm not sure is, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but when you're talking about juveniles, is someone able to identify that type of personality? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not going to make it sound like I've looked at the file of every single juvenile lifer in the state of Michigan. I've looked at many. I've known many of them. I've had numbers of them who locked in my prison when I was a warden. It's complicated. I am comfortable when I hear the Supreme Court say it should be the rarest of cases. My professional experience tells me that's about right.
I'm speaking, if you've just joined us, with Patricia Caruso, the former director of the Michigan Department of Corrections. You submitted an affidavit in support of one prisoner up for reconsideration of his sentence, Christopher Pelletier, and this affidavit was submitted in the 17th Circuit Court for Kent County. Why did you do that?
Well, I do some work as an expert on these cases. I will tell you, I only do expert work on things I agree with. I would never take a case as an expert if I felt different than what I was being asked to attest to. So in this case, I went through the 20 years of this individual's file and how he did his time and his classification and his misconducts. And I felt very comfortable. In his case, he had done 20 years. And the argument by his attorney was looking that he could be resentenced to a minimum of 25 years. And, you know, he'd have a minimum of 5 more years that he'd be incarcerated before he'd be eligible to see the parole board. And in my affidavit, I made a number of statements about feeling comfortable with putting that in the hands of the parole board. Were this individual to have been resentenced to a 25-year minimum, he would have had 5 years of access to resources that he has not had in the last 20 years. You know, this was someone who was doing pretty good time, who had family support and community support, and I know the kinds of things that parole boards look for. So the things I put in the affidavit were things that in general supported that. I do not know that prisoner. I'm not in any way personally saying those things. I'm saying from a systemic standpoint, I think the right place to make these decisions for these people is at the parole board level, because that's what these people do every day, and they take it very seriously.
Yet Michigan's prosecutors certainly are garnering a lot of national attention for their seemingly slow review process and their decisions to uphold life sentences for what seems like a number of prisoners far higher than what would amount to the Supreme Court's rarest standards. And I think many of them would say, and some have told us directly, their focus is providing justice to victims and families and their elected officials, and they don't want a decision they made to cause harm to anyone else and come back to haunt them politically. How difficult is that position, in your view, of a prosecutor in this discussion?
I think it's very difficult, and it's very complicated. I remember someone telling me a number of years ago that the United States was the only country where we elect prosecutors. And it does add a piece to this because I know many prosecutors. I've worked with many prosecutors back to before I was in the Department of Corrections. And in the vast majority are good people trying to do the right thing in tough situations. If you look at the juvenile cases, and the numbers would tell you, they don't deal with many of them. So you're trying to look at things and balance things out, and, you know, what do you look at and what you not look at. And I understand how difficult all of that can be. But one of the problems, and this is a bigger issue than juveniles, is the concept of parole in general and the fear of something bad will happen. I used to say when I was the director of the Department of Corrections that, you know, we were the only arm in law enforcement who deals with 100% convicted felons. You know, we had 50,000 people incarcerated and over 100,000 people on supervision. And, you know, when I was there, 18,000 staff, and I'll put all of that together and all the decisions you're making every day, it's not if something bad happens, it's when. You know, there are many states who have eliminated parole because whether it was the governor or the corrections director or somebody didn't want to get blamed when something bad happened. Something bad's going to happen no matter what we do. I would argue that our responsibility as professionals, wherever we are in that system, is to look at everything we can learn from the research, from what evidence tells us, from our experience tells us, and make the best decisions we can so we do reserve those expensive prison beds for the people who ought to be in them. And that's certainly possible, and this is a good example of times where it's possible. It's easy to just say no. It's easy to say we're going to eliminate parole, then I'm not responsible. Something bad will still happen, but no one can blame me. And that's kind of what that sort of thing feels like, as opposed to making the tough decisions of trying to do the right thing.
Patricia Caruso, the former director of the Michigan Department of Corrections. Patricia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.